This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
For racial and ethnic minorities in the United States, health disparities take on many forms, including higher rates of chronic disease and premature death. The COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted and in many cases widened the gap in both health outcomes and access to quality care, unmasking long-standing inequities that pervade the healthcare system and society at large. I am Alberto Grignolo, Editor-in-Chief of DIA Global Forum. Today, we are joined by Dr. Michelle Durham, Director, Psychiatry Residency Training at Boston Medical Center, to discuss prevailing health disparities before and during the COVID-19 pandemic. We will also look at culturally informed strategies that could effectively narrow the gap in health outcomes. Welcome, Dr. Durham, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My first question, let's begin big picture, if we could. What do you see as the most important inequities within the healthcare sector in general, but also during this pandemic?
Yeah, I'd like to, you know, take a step back a bit and look at the bigger picture. I mean, I think when we narrow it down to inequities in the healthcare sector, they are really just consequences of what happens in each one of our communities and more broadly across the U.S. And for many of us that are in the academic world and in healthcare, I think what's come to light during this time, during COVID-19, as well as the many Black lives that have been lost and people of color in general, is that racism is sort of at the root and heart, unfortunately, of how we got to where we are today. I can speak on that a little bit of thinking about, you know, the IOM, Institute of Medicine report and called Unequal Treatment. Several years ago, talked about data that crosses every therapeutic intervention in the healthcare sector, ranging from the simplest sort of diagnostic tools we use to actually treatments, and that no matter what, Black, Latinx, and other people of color received fewer procedures and poorer quality of medical care than their white counterparts. And then they elucidated, because then the question is always at hand, oh, well, were they not following up or were they, you know, too poor to get the services or maybe they were uninsured? But they actually looked at that too, you know, that these gaps persisted even after differences in health insurance, socioeconomic status, the state and the severity of the disease, any comorbidities, even where they got this treatment or diagnosis, like the medical facility, all that was taken into account. And yet these disparities or inequities persisted. And so that to me means we have to look at sort of our own biases, the discrimination in the healthcare system. And just because we're out in the community sometimes walking down the street or other places and we see these acts of violence and racism and discrimination doesn't mean it doesn't happen in the walls of a health system. So that to me is the big picture of why COVID-19 has really shone a bright light on what all of us, many of us knew. We're just seeing it in these huge proportions of thousands of lives now lost to this pandemic, to this disease, and to the lack of coordinated response to it.
Thank you for that perspective. We can certainly get to, you know, is this a moment that will trigger real change? But before we get to that, could I ask you, how do minority patients experience health disparities on a very personal level? And, you know, in that context, what concerns do they express?
Yeah, I think what happens is that, I mean, what we've, you know, good literature and we see time and time again is that sometimes they feel that whatever they come into the doctor's office with or into the medical system with is sort of minimized. They don't feel heard. People feel like whatever they said in the appointment, it was overlooked. We see this most paramount sometimes in pain, that people come into emergency rooms or into the provider's office and are complaining of have symptoms of pain. And that's sort of, no, you don't, kind of overlooked, not really investigated further. And so then they go home and there's repeated coming back and no one's really listening. There's also some literature out there about thinking about just that engagement and rapport building. Don't feel as connected to their provider. So if they are Black or a person of color, and the their provider happens to be white or someone not of the same racial background as them, they don't feel like they engage completely, that there is no rapport building that sometimes happens when the provider looks like you. And so at a personal level, that makes you not want to engage with the health system. And we all know that we should continue to have our annual visits, that if we do have a problem before it gets too far down the road, we should catch things early. You know, cancer is a big one. We think of for women, cervical cancer or breast cancer, for men, prostate cancer. These are things that if caught early can have a really great prognosis. And so those are the things that get missed when we can't engage fully with our healthcare provider because we don't fully trust them and the system.
You mentioned the aspect of pain, and I've heard, you know, persons from minority groups saying, when I go to the hospital and I say I'm in pain, it is sort of suggested to me in not so subtle ways that I'm actually angling to get opioids and I'm making up the pain. Have you heard, you know, statements or episodes along those lines? I know I've heard this personally from a person.
Yeah, you know, that's definitely also something, you know, well talked about. It happens a lot. You know, I'm here in Boston and I'm at a safety net system, a public hospital in Boston. And we see a lot of people that have sickle cell disease. Sickle cell disease is mostly in black people or people of African descent. And coming into the emergency room, you'll hear often there's, you know, using terminology to describe, oh, that's just typical sickle pain, and not really taking the pain seriously. Unfortunately, I think the opioid epidemic that has happened has made us go to a whole different spectrum of not wanting now to prescribe when it's really needed. And unfortunately, I think this mostly impacts people of color. And so those sentiments are definitely true and definitely talked about in ways that we still need to take every person for face value and figure out what their needs are and how do we best treat them and really put our biases aside.
You refer to what I would call a trust gap between people of color and physicians or healthcare providers who are not of color. Is there any evidence to show that when the physician healthcare provider is of the same, you know, ethnic, racial community as the patient, that actually the patient feels more listened to, more cared for, handled better?
Absolutely. And that's why many of us in the field, and, you know, you mentioned I'm the training director here for the psychiatry program, but across specialty programs, not only in medicine, but, you know, social work programs, psychology programs, any programs that are interfacing with patients are really thinking, you know, even more at this point in time, how do we increase the diversity of the workforce? There's an automatic connection that happens when the provider looks like you, speaks the same language as you, comes from the same community you do, has the same religious background. And I think we can even understand that even outside of research. I think most of us can understand that, right? When we go to a community event, when we go, you know, hanging out with friends, or we go to a restaurant, or we go places, we tend to navigate and really vibe, if you will, with people that have some commonality with us. And so this is not surprising that one way, and I think a huge way to impact some of these inequities that we're seeing in healthcare, and mind you, poor health outcomes, right? Black women die at higher rates when they deliver their child than white women. Black men are dying much earlier than white men. So these are real health outcomes with real consequences. So diversifying the workforce, I think, is first and foremost something we need to do much better than we have been in medicine. There's a term used sort of in the medical field of having underrepresented minorities. And I like to start thinking of it that typically they've actually been excluded. So historically excluded groups from medicine, how can we get them at the table caring for patients in order to essentially reflect this vast, diverse population we have here in the U.S.?
Does that mean in part that the historically Black colleges and universities and medical schools need to turn out more Black physicians and nurses, for example?
Well, I actually think they've done a fantastic job of it, but right, you only have the ability to do that so much. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's the majority white institutions that need to do a better job of recruiting and retaining and building and including people from all walks of life into their institutions. Likely the largest number of Black providers actually come from historically Black colleges and universities, but they should not be the sole institutions that are able to do this.
Right, the sheer number of medical schools in this country at least should be able to drive a lot more graduates who are Black and Latinos into the community, right?
Absolutely. And fundamentally, why wouldn't you want, you know, to have a diverse medical student class? They can learn from each other. We talk about this in many sectors, right? Whether it's, you know, the business sector, academics, you know, whatever sector, you know, we have in the U.S. of different businesses, we know that we should look around the table when you're having meetings and think more. So who isn't at the table with a voice about this particular issue? You look around the table and it's only one type of person. We're likely not getting a lot of different ways to look at a problem. And I think that if we have more physicians and more people in the medical school field, medical school classes, nursing classes, social work classes that can offer different perspective, it'll make for a richer educational experience for that person. But ultimately, I think we all win in the end because they're going to go out and work in institutions and other centers across the country, and that maybe patients then will want to engage in a different way as well.
It seems clear that the ratio of minority physicians and nurses to patients is a very low ratio. So if that ratio were to be much higher, would that go a long, long way towards addressing the trust gap between patients and physicians who are not from their own community? If there were many more, minority physicians and nurses in relation to the number of minority patients, if there was a higher probability that a minority patient gets to see a physician or nurse from their own community, their ethnic group and race, would that address the trust gap that exists, the credibility, that how believed a patient is by that physician or nurse?
I believe so. And people are doing more and more research in this area, especially now, but even prior to this time, there are definitely scholars out there that they have been concentrating on this particular issue for years. And we do believe that the inequities will be reduced. And anecdotally, you hear it. I've definitely heard medical students, people in residency training, they're talking about this more, about, you know, I had a Black patient today, or I'm a PD resident. They'll say, like, you know, the mother was really excited that their child was going to have a Latinx doctor. So you hear these stories anecdotally all the time. But I honestly do, and many of us that have done some of this work really believe that the U.S. is so diverse. And so we really just across the spectrum need that to be reflected in the healthcare field. The gap, though, is most substantial for Black and Latinx. Not enough of those providers that identify as Black and Latinx are serving patients. And so that's a huge problem. I think we also know lots of reasons for that, but we need to increase the pipeline and think of ways, innovative ways, to have more people recruited into those healthcare fields.
Do you believe that we are in a moment in history where real change can be made and be sustainable? Or is this just another moment in history where lip service is being paid to the need to take action, but nothing much will really change?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I grapple with that myself. It definitely feels like, you know, this isn't just a moment, but a movement. And that feels good at many levels. But then I've also been in meetings where people are talking a lot about racial and health equity and afraid to say words such as racism. And that worries me because I feel we're beyond thinking about just discrimination, and people get really scared by that word, if you will. I think people feel targeted with those words, and that it feels uncomfortable. And I would say, like, we have to move towards that uncomfort and sit with it. And that's okay. We're not gonna make substantial change if we don't sit with some of that discomfort. And racism is rooted in a lot of our policies, you know, this term systemic racism, structural racism. We've heard those terms, they're coming out much more during this time than ever before. But there are real policies that have been made at the federal level, things that have happened in communities of color at the federal level for years, for hundreds of years. So if people don't want to personalize it, I say, okay, but let's just talk about it from a policy, institutional, societal level. There have been lots of things that have happened that are due to racism. And so there's a lot of undoing that's going to have to happen over the next several years. And I just hope that we can all push each other a bit, push our own discomfort in that, to really ultimately, right, what everybody wants is just equal opportunity. That if a little kid in the middle of a city that maybe has lower resources, how can we get that kid more resources so they have the same opportunity to go to medical school as the kid with lots of resources? That's the ultimate point. And I hope that we can see that and really keep pushing, and that this isn't just a moment, but a movement.
It suggests, again, I'm really drawing from your thoughts, that we all need to be willing to have the difficult conversations that do include the term racism, to your point, and not being afraid to have that conversation and to make ourselves vulnerable to have that conversation, knowing that we might possibly misspeak or say the wrong thing, but we need to all sort of jump in and have the conversation. Am I extrapolating too far from what you meant, or is that in line with your meaning?
No, I think it's definitely in line. I think racism has gotten this, you know, it doesn't feel good to, you know, certain groups of people. Nobody wants to be called a racist. Nobody wants to feel like what they said, even if it was in one moment in time, was racist. But at the end of the day, people's lives, right? Health outcomes, we've talked about earlier, how people move through a community, how they get educated, the fact that some communities don't have healthy food that they can go get in their community, that their public school system, you know, maybe one of the lowest in the state. These are all policies that were really tied to structural racism, to devalue, to disempower certain groups of people. And so we have to call that out. If we don't call that out, then I don't know how far we can get in this movement. So we have to start calling it out, but then also, how do we do better so that people do have equal opportunity?
You mentioned the term structural racism, and I've heard it in other contexts as well or other places. Can you just define for us what you mean by structural racism?
It's really thinking about structures, policies within an institution, state policy, federal policies, quite frankly, that have disenfranchised certain groups of people. We see this the most in sort of housing, employment, and education. A good example of this is historically, there's been discrimination around thinking about where people live, and they've called that redlining. Redlining is a perfect example of sort of that structural racism, right? That way for government, they systematically didn't provide resources to Black neighborhoods as they deemed them a financial risk. So there was literally, there's now been generations of Black Americans that have been forced to live in areas that lack access to certain things that some of us in other communities have good access to. They blocked access to capital, to certain fundamental things that would happen in public education, even to financing for home ownership. So you would go to the mortgage lender and they would say, no, you live in that certain neighborhood or community. We're not going to help you get a house, own. And we know that this has trickle-down effects, obviously. You don't have the same ability for financial gain. I think this equates to the healthcare system in a way where, in many ways, but one way, right, is that those same communities, I had mentioned like healthy food options, right? Like most of us can go with ease to get that. But then if you're not making a lot of money, you go to the corner store, there's lots of carbs and all these snacks that aren't really that healthy for you. Or there's likely, you know, a fast food chain always in these lower socioeconomic communities. For a couple dollars, you can get a whole meal, usually loaded in fat and cholesterol.
That's right.
But we know how that trickle down effects. So it leads to obesity, it leads to high blood pressure, it leads to high cholesterol, diabetes. Then they come into the healthcare system, they do have an appointment with their PCP, and all of these issues are going on. But they're still in that same community with, you know, low access to any of these things, job strain, multi-generation homes, because of a historical thing that has happened in the US and quite frankly has continued to happen in many ways. So those are very rooted in sort of public health interventions, you know, not really medicine is the end result of all of these inequities, in the sense that now the person has to continuously come to the doctor. But what can we do further back? You know, how can we help with resources, thinking about fundamentals of like, how does one, you know, increase their earnings, get a college education, be able to own a home? All of these things increase wealth. And that generational wealth has never really been able to happen in ways it happened for other people.
And that speaks of the structural nature of this, laws, correct, regulations, and local ordinances, et cetera. And cascading then down to health delivery, another term that one hears is culturally responsive care, culturally responsive care. Can you tell us what that means? And what are some examples of that?
Yeah, you know, in the healthcare system, I think of a few ways we've done that. And, you know, the hope is that everywhere is doing it. And I think sometimes money and finances particularly may get away in some, you know, probably in some centers across the U.S. But the ability to have an interpreter at every patient encounter. Here where I work, you know, there's three top languages, Spanish, Haitian, Creole, Cape Verdean. We have many interpreters that can help in medical appointments, whether in person or on the phone. We have iPads. But that's one way to be culturally responsive, not try to figure out how you're going to just use hand motions to get through an appointment with the patient, right? Like, you're really not going to get at the root cause of why they're there and what's going on if you can't understand what they're saying.
Exactly. Yeah.
Another good example, and what we've seen a lot more federally qualified health centers using, and we also have some here at our academic center, is what we've termed community health workers. And they've really been an invaluable part of the workforce. Typically, they are bilingual, bicultural, and of the community, meaning they live in the communities that many of our patients are also living in. They, you know, could also be thought of as like a cultural broker. That term is used often. You know, if they do, because they will likely engage with a provider that is not, does not look like them, does not speak their language. So how can that community health worker bridge the gap there? You know, they usually understand something about the office setting, the setting where the provider is. And so they're helping to communicate to that patient some of the nuances that maybe they don't understand. And then the other, bidirectionally, to the provider too. Culturally, maybe what's accepted in their culture, why maybe they're having a difficult time understanding this particular provider. So it's been a really great and fantastic addition to our workforce, the community health worker.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. Moving to our current predicament as pandemic impacted societies, lots of pharmaceutical companies are trying to find treatments, vaccines. There are clinical research organizations that are doing thousands of clinical trials involving thousands of patients. So in the context of this conversation, how can an industry that is really trying to address the pandemic therapeutically and preventively, how can that industry address the needs of the community that is underrepresented in clinical research, that is over-impacted by the pandemic, as you've described in very articulated fashion? How can the trust of the community into the clinical research and drug development enterprise be enhanced for the benefit of all, including communities that are suffering disproportionately and who will need the treatments and vaccines of the future and yet may hesitate to participate in clinical research? I'm really curious about your thoughts about this.
I think a lot of like patient advisory boards, and I don't know if the similar thing can sort of happen in sort of this research in a way. I think patients or community leaders who are engaged in certain communities in ways to really bridge that gap and that trust that has happened for, you know, years now of not wanting to engage in clinical research. What I want to say too is, I understand completely why, you know, Black people in particular would not want to engage, right? Tuskegee, things that have happened that were not just essentially the medical system did not fully disclose. What are we doing, right, with informed consent? What is it going to be used for? And how will this affect you if you participate? And so that needs to be very clear, that that understanding of that mistrust and why, because the healthcare system has not done things to be very trustful. And so I think it's, again, and how do you engage community leaders and or patients, and having like a patient advisory board? We're starting to do a lot more of that in research here to really inform how maybe clinical trials, to give you a window into what may be helpful in their community. None of us are going to have that answer if we don't go to the community and ask. And I think that that's a really important part that's often missed in lots of research. We ask the questions, you know, the MDs, the PhDs, you know, the nurses. We ask the questions and then want to go out in the community and study. But can we ask the questions with the community? Can they be at the table too? What questions are important to them as well? And I don't think we do that enough. And I think community engagement is really important to any research process, and really in all phases of the research process. Even if that's just like, this is what we were thinking, this is what we planned, what do you think, what are the thoughts, and bringing people in to really understand that. I think at the point of a clinical trial, though, it is important to have, again, just like you would in a healthcare visit, people that reflect the patient population to help with some of the studies. Whether that's whoever's, you know, giving in the injection that day, or going to be dispensing the pill, or, you know, are there going to be other people around that reflect the patients? I think it's important to build trust. It just fundamentally is. So I would, you know, really think about how do you get community leaders involved to really push the needle on having people participate in more of these research trials.
And who might those community leaders be? I'm looking for, you know, titles, positions, roles, that sort of thing. Can you illuminate a little bit? What is a community leader? Is it a pastor in a church?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, there's a few research projects. They're literally running groups and got buy-in, if you will, by starting there. Started with the head, the leader of the church, the pastor, the reverend. Got their thoughts initially, figured out what they could do, then set up, you know, focus groups within the church, didn't ask them to come to the medical center at all. The researchers went to them, established focus groups there. But absolutely, there's good addiction work happening in that way. Even thinking about, you know, medication for addiction, all happening in the community with the leaders at the table. And then that builds that trust. If my reverend, the pastor, if the head of this particular, you know, Salvation Army, you know, we always go to the community center for fun. But if that person, the director there, trusts this person, then I'm able to trust too.
Considering that the mistrust has accumulated over decades, you mentioned the Tuskegee experiment, the 40s, 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. into the 70s. Will it take decades to build this trust? The problem is that we don't have decades. The COVID is right now. Treatment and vaccines are needed right now. And people need to participate in clinical trials from all communities so that we will know if these treatments and vaccines work in all communities. We actually don't have decades. We have maybe months. Can this trust be built in the next several months?
You know, I think so. I'm not involved directly with some of the trials happening here around COVID-19. But we definitely have our infectious disease docs that we're able to get it up and running and have recruited more than ever. And our patient population here is 70% Black and Latinx. That's how they identify. And they've done a really nice job. So building trust, you know, I don't think it needs to take decades, but there has to be just being very transparent. And I realize that the workforce won't evolve probably for another 10 to 20 years as well. But being transparent, upfront, maybe acknowledging that history a bit, I think can engage people in a way that maybe we weren't if we sort of ignore that discrimination, racism, that really negative and bad things have happened. But acknowledging it, I think, is the first step to building trust with anyone.
And then, of course, applying the protections afforded by good clinical practice, informed consent, the right to withdraw at any time, giving the patient full freedom to do what a patient must do in his or her best interest, including dropping out of a trial.
Absolutely.
Well, big issues. I think we need to end our conversation here, but it's been so illuminating for me to listen to you and really appreciate your thoughts, your insights, your commitment, and the passion that you clearly display, Dr. Durham. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.